Caroline Baum has been writing and talking about books and literature for many years. Caroline founded Good Reading magazine. She was the host of the book show Between the Lines on ABC TV. And now, after all these years, Caroline Baum has written a book of her own. It's a memoir of her turbulent relationship with her mother and father. Caroline grew up in a big house in outer London as an only child of immense privilege. Her parents were rich. There were stacks of presents on birthdays and at Christmas. There were holidays in Paris, good restaurants, and beautiful clothes. Caroline was never allowed to forget how precious she was to them. Both her parents had been orphaned, in a way, in completely different and utterly tragic circumstances. And so they would tell her, "You're the only one we've got." This is the life of the only child. And so Caroline's memoir is called Only. Hello, Caroline.
Hello, Richard.
There's a very lovely picture of you as a little girl. No one's sure whether you're 4 or 6 in this picture of you on the cover. You've sort of got this sundress on that's bright red with flowers. There's a sunflower in your hair, and you've got a very cheeky smile on your face. Are there lots of photos of you as a little girl?
Oh, yes. There is an immense archive, Richard. My mother had a very beautiful Leica and then a state-of-the-art Nikon, big, heavy cameras, and she was kind of the resident paparazzi, if you like, at home, in that it didn't matter what I was doing, if I had a new dress or if my hair had just been cut, whatever it was, I was always being asked to sort of pose for a photograph. So I was quite self-conscious as a child. But I did also like the posing, you know, because I liked the dresses. I liked the sort of sense of occasion that it gave.
You say the family dynamic in an only child family is a triangle. Now, what kind of a triangle is this? Is this a triangle resting on its base, like the Great Pyramids of Giza, or is it sort of balancing on its tip? And how does this shape work, Caroline?
Well, for me, it's interesting that you ask that, Richard, because when I was writing the book, the way I saw the triangle was as a piece of chocolate, a Toblerone mountain. My father could consume one of those whole rows of Alps made of chocolate with nougat in one go, the giant version, you know, the jumbo size Alps, without asking either my mother or myself whether we would like a little mountain of our own.
Oh, that's right there, Caroline. There's trauma in that,
I think. That's yes. 5 years worth right. of therapy right there. So I used to see my father at the top of the chocolate mountain. But now, in a funny kind of way, having written the book, I see the triangle inverted. I see myself at the bottom, and I see the pressure of their pasts and their history weighing on me.
The family home you describe in Wimbledon was very, very spacious. What do you remember of that house, living in that house?
Well, I remember lots of things. I do, first of all, remember that I had 2 rooms of my own. So I had an extensive sort of wing, if you like, of the house. I only realised that other children didn't have a bedroom and a playroom and a bathroom of their own when I went to other people's houses, when I went to friends' houses, when I was eventually allowed out of the fortress, because the house was very much like a prison in that the windows all had bars on them and the doors were heavily bolted. They were always locked at night. The house was robbed quite a lot, which is a bit ironic given the level of security. But I think my father was quite obsessed with protecting us from incursion and assault from enemies, as it were, because he had had such a traumatic childhood that he was in a permanent hypervigilant state. And so the house felt very, it was meant to feel very secure, but there was something forbidding about that. And even the atmosphere in the house felt charged and different. So again, when I went to friends' houses, I realized that everything was lighter, that doors weren't always locked, that windows could open. And it was as if the molecular structure of the oxygen in my house was heavy. Everything about our house was heavy. The hallways downstairs were panelled with timber, dark timber, and everything about the house was a bit gloomy and forbidding. And so my house soon got a reputation amongst my friends for not being fun, and they didn't really want to come to play with me.
You say that your birthdays and Christmas were very lavish. There were lots of presents under the Christmas tree for you. Nothing was really withheld in that sense in terms of gifts. What were your birthday parties like, Caroline?
Oh, well, my birthday parties were very strange, I now realise. Of course, to me, they seemed normal at the time. My father was in the travel business and he had a lot of contacts with the top London hotels, particularly the ones, the sort of what we would now call five-star, but that category didn't exist then, the top hotels in Mayfair and in the West End. And so when I was about five or six, I would invite all my classmates to these lavish affairs at the Dorchester, for example, and we would have jelly in little fluted, pleated plates, and we would play very vigorous, animated games of Pass the Parcel and musical chairs on little gilded chairs, and then we would have a magician, and then we would always have a screening of a film by Laurel and Hardy, and I would never laugh. I never found them funny.
They're hilarious. Do you like them now?
Now I do. But, you know, then I was a very serious, intense child.
To anyone outside your family, I'm sure there were mutterings, that young Caroline, she's spoilt. What do you think of that phrase, spoilt?
Well, Richard, I think it's a very easy, lazy label to give only children generally. And, I'm not a campaigner for the rights of the only child, but there is no doubt that we have an image problem. And that image problem, I don't know when it started, but, you know, I have to say, Jesus was an only child. And nobody ever said he had a problem with sharing, did they? I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not comparing myself to Jesus. Don't think for a moment I am.
Put down your pens. Step away from the keyboard. Let's be clear about that.
But around the time that psychology emerged as a profession, the first child psychologists in the 19th century categorized only children as deviants and said that it was better for people not to have single children because if they had them, they would be a liability and a burden on society. And I don't actually think that the perception of the only child has changed very much. So when I hear that word spoilt, my hackles do go up a little bit, as you can obviously tell, because, you know, nobody feels that they can walk around sort of free rein and say to a middle child, oh, I bet you're an underachiever. But when you meet an only child, it's kind of open slather to say to them, oh, I bet you were spoilt and you're really bad at sharing.
And that's acceptable. You write that there's in that family you had with all this privilege that was lavished on you, there is a weight of expectation. I think your phrase for it is there's a kind of a dark undertow that was working underneath that, like having given you all that stuff. What was expected in return from you?
Well, I think the transaction was not clear at the beginning. It took me a long time to understand that the possessions, that all that material comfort and abundance served many purposes. For my parents, it was a way of creating a sort of buffer against the turbulence of history that had stripped them and robbed them of everything, primarily their childhoods, actually. But with me, this thing of giving me stuff was there was an unspoken kind of exchange, and it was about conditions that were expectations. So in a way, you know, Pip in Dickens's great classic is an only child. And I would say that I also lived with great expectations that you can have all these things, you can have this lovely, beautiful, comfortable, pampered, privileged life, but you must conform to our expectations. And also the other complicating factor I now understand in all of that is that my father treated me like a possession. I was property. There was only one of me, and I was made to feel like I was an asset, and that all of our conversations were really about whether he was getting a return on his investment.
What would happen if you rebelled when you acted up and had a tantrum or threatened to do something he didn't like?
Well, I was quite an insolent child, and I did learn from the fact that my father was very argumentative. I learnt to argue back and to answer back. I was quite what we would now call lippy or mouthy. And to some extent, he encouraged that. He quite liked the sort of blood sport of the verbal combat and jousting at the dinner table. But he also had been brought up in an old-fashioned Prussian style. You know, he was brought up to sit at the table with a newspaper under each arm so that his elbows didn't wing out at the table, and he undoubtedly was beaten as a form of absolutely normal discipline in his day. And so when I was naughty, when I was insolent, for example, or when I told a whopping great lie, because I was quite bad at the whoppers, I was beaten, and I was beaten with a specific leather travel slipper, a little calfskin, fine-grained, tan-coloured slipper. I can remember it. I can see it right now. It came in a little zip-up case. And the ritual was that if I was being disciplined, I had to present myself to my father's bedroom, and I had to lie face down on the bed, and he would give me 5 or 10, you know, really fairly hard whacks. And the worst part of the punishment, the worst, was that when it was over, after I had screamed blue murder into the pillows, he would ask me to kiss him to say, it's all over now and it's all forgotten. And that kiss was more painful than the beating.
The beating from the designer slipper.
Yeah, but the humiliation came from the kiss. Mm.
Did being an only child make you more or less inclined towards group play, team sports, that kind of thing, Caroline?
I was so useless at all of that. It has to be said, it was made worse by the fact that I went to a French school, and French schools are all about cultivating the individual. They have absolutely no idea about team spirits or team sports of any kind, so those were not encouraged. They weren't part of the timetable. But, you know, when you're an only child, you don't get to play board games. You don't get to shuffle cards. You don't do relays or tag teams. So I was phenomenally uncoordinated. And also, I had absolutely no competitive spirit. And I've talked to other only children about this. Quite recently, I was talking to Robert Desay about it, in fact. And he said he also had absolutely no idea about what competition was for. I mean, I like playing tennis, but I like a kind of hit and giggle. I don't play to win.
What about the idea of the kind of joshing that goes on between siblings, where you give each other a hard time across the table and fight over food and all
yes,
that stuff?
Yes, yes. My husband says that that's really my Achilles heel as an only child, that he says that I'm very literal when I'm teased, and that because I had no practice at being teased by siblings around the table, I get offended quickly. And I think that, you know, the point about all of these forms of behavior as an only child, Richard, is you can learn to manage and correct them. Yeah. So, okay, you might be a poorly socialized only child, but you can learn how to share food. You can learn how to be teased and take it on the chin. So I hope that somewhere along the line between the way I was at 7 and the way I am now at 50-something, I've learnt some of those things.
Yes, you just had to move to the other side of the world in order
exactly.
to be able to do it. That's all. I think so much of this story, I think, Caroline, is about the absence of your parents having a childhood too. Can you just tell me a bit about how they met one another? Where and how did they meet each other and fall in love?
Yes. Well, they met in Paris when my father had rather a good job working as a sort of bureaucrat, I think, for UNESCO. And my mother, he hired my mother as his secretary because he wanted a bilingual secretary. He loved living in Paris, and my mother was extremely beautiful.
Yeah, like movie star beautiful.
Movie star beautiful, I have to say. I mean, I think everybody thinks that their mother is beautiful, but my mother was really spectacularly beautiful. Very dramatic cheekbones, liquid velvet eyes. Her features were very sort of Spanish and quite sort of angular. My father used to say at home to me, your mother is the most beautiful woman in the world. And again, in one of these sort of jousting argument sort of phases, I would say, well, what about Elizabeth Taylor? What about Sophia Loren? And he would say, no, they're vulgar. No, they've got too much makeup on. So despite the fact that, you know, later on in the book, I say that he was a philanderer and he was not faithful, he did have a kind of aesthetic appreciation and reverence for my mother's beauty. And I think, Richard, what's sad for me about this story is that my mother, because of her tragic circumstances, was looking for security. And my father certainly could offer her that. My father was attracted by the glamour of my mother's appearance. But really, what the undertow was, that was really pulling them together was the kind of magnetic force of tragedy. And I sort of visualized them as like iron filings being drawn together. And actually, by the time they realized how incompatible they were, it was too late. And I don't think that they ever really properly discussed the fact that the absence of a childhood had made them the damaged people that they were and brought them together. I don't think that they indulged in the kind of introspection that maybe our generation does. You know, our parents didn't go in for therapy. They didn't go in so much for the examined life because they were too busy surviving.
How did your dad come to tell you that he was Jewish? Like, he was Jewish, your mother was not, but your father was. How did he let you know that he was Jewish and there was Jewishness on that side of the family?
Well, I mean, various things sort of came together. I found some terrible books in the spare room full of pictures of emaciated people and piles of hair.
Well, he bought histories then, did he, of the Holocaust?
And, he had a Holocaust library, and I stumbled across it in a room that was locked. And when my parents were out, I found that library and thought, my God, who are these people? And then, of course, at school, the first time I was asked to draw a family tree, which was a completely innocuous exercise at school, I came home and said to my father, okay, you know, can you help me with this? And he burst into tears, which was incredibly distressing. I had seen my father cry once before, but it was nonetheless very shocking. And it, you know, we couldn't draw the first branch of the tree. And basically, he was tormented by a terrible guilt that he had lost this entire tree of people. And he couldn't remember their names. Some of his cousins, whom he'd holidayed with in Hungary, he loved them dearly. He could remember their faces, but suddenly he couldn't remember their names.
Tell me how he taught you your first Hebrew prayer.
Oh, gosh. He leaned over me one evening when he was tucking me into bed and said, repeat after me. And he said the words of the prayer, Shema Israel Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. And I didn't really know what it meant, but he said it meant, thou shalt have no other God but me. And I took that to mean that he was God, which in a way, in our house, he was, because he was such a tyrant and such a despot, that such an imposing, domineering, controlling figure, that he didn't give me any kind of religious context for this prayer. He wanted me to know that he was proud of being Jewish and that this was my heritage, but he never inducted me into it. So we never went to a synagogue together, for example.
Did he ask you to memorize that prayer?
Those words. Yes, absolutely. I had to repeat them until I knew them by heart.
See, right there, that is just like the absolute classic case of a parent telling their child something where the meaning in the parent's mind is really clear, not understanding that the child is hearing a completely different thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing about this is that my father was adopted. He was fostered into a Quaker family when he came to England through the Kindertransport refugee program, which extracted 10,000 mostly Jewish children from the clutches of the Nazis in December 1938. But he always said to me that if he hadn't been born Jewish, he would like to have been a Quaker because he thought they were the best people on earth. So I didn't really know what being Jewish meant to my father, except that later in life I really got that for him his Viennese Jewish heritage in terms of literature and above all music was something that he was immensely proud of. And that's something that I've inherited a little bit. You know, I'm very honoured to have that lineage, but I don't really have an affinity or a connection with Judaism.
You say he was brought out of Vienna before the war, the Kindertransport scheme that brought a lot of Jewish children out of Austria, in this case, out of Vienna and to England. Who got out with him, Caroline?
His sister. his elder sister. So the way kinder transport worked, children between the ages of 7 and 17 were eligible. So my father had an older sister, Francie, who was 5 years older than him, and each child was told that they could take a tiny, tiny little case about the size of a satchel, or I suppose a briefcase, with them, and their parents would take them to the station and say to them that they would join them in a few weeks' time. 90% of kinder never saw their parents again. And the extraordinary thing is that they were put on the trains, and at the other end they were met by volunteers who took them to a camp, a sort of Butlin's holiday camp. And on Sundays the children could be visited and sort of inspected by prospective foster candidates. So my father and sister absolutely, and his sister absolutely insisted that they didn't want to be separated, which made it harder to find a home for them. So they stayed in that selection camp and were inspected on Sundays while they were having lunch by numerous, numerous foster parents who decided that two older children were more difficult than young children. And also my father by then was wearing spectacles, and apparently children with spectacles were less likely to be selected than children without. So they had to wait quite a long time. So it was a very, very traumatic time in their lives.
He eventually joined the British Army towards the end of the war, and was stationed back in Vienna, but this time as a young man in a British Army uniform. Tell me what happened when he returned to Vienna.
Yeah. Well, he was adopted into an extraordinary Quaker family. There was no vetting, so it was absolutely random, good luck, bad luck, who you got. But he happened to get a family who were salt of the earth. And I think that he felt such a debt to Britain for taking him in that he wanted to repay it. And so he signed up to join the British Army as part of the intelligence corps, as it was then, undertaking something called denazification, which was a very naive attempt to sort of purify Germany and Austria and remove all traces of Nazi ideology from every aspect of life. And so he was sent on a mission to Vienna. You know, he was a great asset because of his language skills. A lot of the people who volunteered for denazification were not properly bilingual, which made it particularly hard. And his job was to go to the university in Vienna and sit at the back of the hall and listen to lectures. And if he heard any lecturer spouting any ideology, he was to arrest them. Well, he had an afternoon off, and he decided completely spontaneously that he would go back to the family home just to see who was there. And he rang the doorbell, and he heard some steps coming to the door, and there was a little spyglass in the door, and then he heard this great sort of crashing, thumping thud, and no one opened the door. And then he rang the bell again, and then he heard some more footsteps coming to the door, and a shriek on the other side of the door from a woman, and she opened the door, and it was the neighbours. It was the Tuliceks, who had lived next door to my father's family. And when my father's family had had to flee the Nazis, the Tuliceks had moved in, and there was Mr. Tulicek in a faint on the floor from the shock of seeing my father through the eyeglass and thinking, oh my God, he's come back for everything. And the rugs, the family possessions, were all there. My father took in this scene of the man unconscious on the floor and his horrified wife bending over him, and he turned on his heels and left without a word. When he told me the story, he told me that Mr. Tulicek had died at the sight of him, and I think that that's because my father wanted to kill him.
Yeah. What's it like for you to go to a city like Vienna now?
Not great, I have to say. I feel the weight of history. I feel that behind all that beautiful Habsburg gilding, there is a very, very sinister story that has not been fully acknowledged and resolved. I did go back with my father once because he was very keen to take me to the opera and for me to hear the Vienna Philharmonic and to eat chocolate cake. And in the middle of strolling down one of the posh streets that we were admiring, he saw a man in a Tyrolean hat and a Loden coat, and he ran down the street after him, calling him a Nazi. And the man, who was elderly and frail, raised his cane in self-defense. And I felt such shame and embarrassment, Richard. I was appalled at my father's behaviour. He was completely incensed and out of control.
Was the guy a Nazi?
How would we know? But, you know, it was just the coat and the hat were triggers to my father, and he just went off.
Oh, Caroline, your mother was also an orphan.
I should just say, yes, Richard, my father lost his father in the war, but he did manage to get his mother out. So he's only half an orphan, whereas my mother is the full deal.
And alongside with the loss of his father, there would have been countless other relatives.
Indeed, yes, all of the rest of the family perished.
And these are the people whose names many of whom he couldn't remember when he was asking to draw the family tree. And is this something that sort of you came to realise over time, Caroline, the kind of the full magnitude of this awful tragedy?
Yes, because when we went to Israel, we went, of course, obligatorily to Yad Vashem, to the Holocaust Memorial, and there they have an incredible archive that you can access, and you can just go and look up your family. And my mother kept saying to my father, look them up, look them up. And he didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to know. He wanted to move on.
Broadcast, podcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feiler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Your mum's story, Caroline. What did you know about her childhood story when you were little?
Nothing. Nothing at all. She existed completely in a vacuum as this beautiful creature who cooked the most wonderful meals in the world and decorated our house with beautiful flower arrangements and was always beautifully dressed and was really only, you know, you're so self-absorbed as a child. You're using all your energy to grow yourself. And so you often don't have any curiosity about your parents.
But you must have asked, you know, where are your parents, Mum?
Well, I did notice that I didn't have grandparents. And of course, again, when I went to other people's houses, they had these other people at the dinner table. And I thought, who are they? These older people who are nice and kind and tell stories and give cuddles. Why don't I have any of those? And so I only understood what grandparents were by visiting other people. They were never mentioned. And my mother's story, unfortunately, is a very, very extreme example of domestic violence.
How old were you when you were able to finally ask her the question directly, what happened to your parents?
I don't think I asked directly until I was in my 20s. And
what happened when you did?
Oh, you know, I got a sort of rather spiky kind of response, which was, so you want to know now? But, you know, she'd never volunteered anything, and I can understand why she hadn't volunteered, because the story is so ghastly.
Well, what had happened to them?
So my grandparents, my French grandparents, were very young. Apparently my grandmother was 17 when she had my mother. She was a bit of a flibbertigibbet. She liked to go out dancing. She liked to go to music halls. And my grandfather was in the Navy, but he was also an amateur boxer. So he must have had a fairly aggressive temperament, and he was also very jealous. He became convinced that my grandmother had been unfaithful to him. And one day when she was at work, she worked in a sort of money lending sort of betting agency in Paris on the Avenue de la Grande Armée, one of the great spokes of the Arc de Triomphe. He came at lunchtime to see her, and he was armed with a revolver, and he shot her in broad daylight. He shot her three times, and then he turned the gun on himself and shot himself. And in that moment, my mother was orphaned. Now, my mother believed that this had happened to her at the age of 2. She always told me that she had no recognition of her parents. She couldn't remember their voices, their faces, their smell, nothing about them, because I pressed her on that. Once she started to tell me the story. But subsequently, we went on a bit of a journey together, thanks to Google, and we discovered that, in fact, this had happened to her when she was 5, and she had completely blocked out any memory of her parents, because apparently the difference between it happening at 2 and happening at 5 is that 5 she should have recalled something about them, but she was too traumatized.
So your grandfather shot your grandmother dead in the streets of Paris, pretty much in public in any case.
In public, in broad daylight. And then
shot himself.
And shot himself. And the kicker to that terrible story is that he died instantly. She took 3 days to die of her wounds in a hospital and was able to give a statement to the police at her deathbed. So I have read her final words to the police on the front page of a Parisian newspaper. My grandfather had a note on his body which said something along the lines of, "Everything disgusts me, and I preferred to drag my wife with me than to endure any more suffering." So I think the note started, it was addressed to his mother, and it said, "I'm sorry, but everything disgusts me, blah, blah, blah."
So both your mother and your father, in completely different circumstances, had had their childhoods more or less annihilated in these moments. Does that explain their precious treatment of you? Does that make it more understandable to
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. I understand it completely differently. I forgive them for all the sort of stifling hothouse anxiety. You know, they could never be free of anxiety. It was sort of genetically encoded into them. They were always on the lookout for where the next catastrophe might come from. And they wanted to infect me with that virus and that awareness, and I was always rejecting it and always pushing it away and saying to them, "But people are good, and the way to move through the world is with trust." And they just looked at me and thought, "Oh my God, you know, she's just going to get
killed."
Dragged
away, killed. She's got to wake up and accept how dangerous everything is all the time.
And, you know, when I subsequently, of course, you know, I did go into therapy, and a therapist pointed out to me that it's highly likely in a crime like the one that my grandfather committed, that doesn't come out of the blue, Richard. You don't shoot someone and then shoot yourself without there having been a preamble. So although my mother doesn't remember it, it is highly likely that she witnessed my grandfather beating or hitting my mother. There was a build-up to this. Certainly.
Do you think this makes their attraction to one another more comprehensible too, this shared sense of tragedy that they were holding?
I do, but I've never forgotten a conversation that they had one day at dinner, where one of the very, very few moments I can remember them discussing these two stories. And my mother, her eyes were glinting like jet beads, and she kind of leaned forward across the table to my father, because we always had these discussions over very intense but very delicious dinners that my mother cooked, and she said, "At least what happened to you happened to millions of others. What happened to me only happened to me." And in that moment, I had this terrible insight of how, for her, suffering was a form of competition between them, which is a terrible, terrible legacy.
You were very precocious. You tended to blitz exams, came to top in the school or the, I was going to say the state, but you don't have states in the UK,
no.
But you did very, very well. And you won a competition to work at British Vogue when you were what, 16?
Yes.
16?
16.
My God. What kind of assignments were you given as this 16-year-old writing for British Vogue, Karen?
Oh, well, there wasn't really too much for me to do. I had to sit in the features department and answer phones for the various very glamorous editors that ran that department, and they were women who became great role models to me, who were phenomenally smart and irreverent and had absolutely no time for the fashion people on the other side of the hallway. They would come in wearing galoshes, or they would come in wearing sort of, you know, secondhand, what we would now call vintage clothes, but I didn't know the word vintage back then. But they were really brainy, bookish women, and I loved being amongst them. So I was just like blotting paper, just soaking up their conversations about theatre and film and books, which were not dissimilar to the conversations we had at home.
It was always understood that you'd go to Oxford University. That was the understanding. Your father just knew it was going to happen. You knew it was going to happen. You were offered several scholarships to Oxford, but you turned them down because you thought you'd get better ones, and in the end you were knocked back altogether.
Yes.
How did you and your father take that news, Caroline?
Badly, Richard. Badly? Really badly. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it does sound like my father could turn on the waterworks, and he certainly was sentimental, and I don't want to give the impression that he cried all the time, but I would say that the day that I screwed up the Oxford admission, he and I lay on his bed side by side, and despite the fact that we had a very, very difficult relationship through my adolescence, in that moment on that bed, we were keening like Irish people keen. We were wailing because it wasn't that, oh, little princess didn't get what she wanted. It wasn't about that at all. What Oxford represented for me, I couldn't even have articulated this at the time, but Oxford for me represented acceptance into the fabric of British society, because I felt, I knew without it ever being said, that my parents were migrants and they were outsiders. And Oxford came to represent being on the inside. And as an only child, you're already always on the outside looking at groups. You want to be inside them. Sometimes when you're inside them, you want to run away from them. But you want to be integrated, and that knowledge that I had, that intuition I had that my parents were outsiders, I thought that if I could get into Oxford, it would be the crowning achievement that would allow us to be a truly British family.
Oh, right.
And the thing about Oxford that is so symptomatic of being an only child, and I've seen this in my career, I never, unlike a lot of young professional women that I knew, I never found myself a mentor. I never asked people for advice. Only children make decisions by themselves because they've been doing everything by themselves for so long that they're independent and they're autonomous. And so I never went to a teacher at school and said, look, I've been offered all these scholarships to study Russian. I don't want to study Russian. I want to study philosophy. What do I do? If I had asked for help, I would have got in because, as you say, I was being offered everything.
But you didn't know how to ask for help.
No. Big lesson there.
You eventually went to university, York University, and after that you became a researcher on the Parkinson Show, Parkinson's Interview Show, and then for Melvyn Bragg as well, and there's plenty of story associated with that as well. But eventually you moved to Australia, and that was for love, was it? Was it for love? Or
that was for love, yes. It was for love. I married my first husband, and then I fell in love with Australia. So when that first marriage ended, I had become so completely in love with the light here. I went back to England, actually, at the end of my first marriage for a year. I thought, oh, well, the Australian chapter is closed. And I got seasonal adjustment deficiency. I started walking into walls. I was incredibly miserable. I had no real reason to be miserable. I was free again. I had kind of done what I needed to do at that stage, and I thought that everything should be fine. And I went to see a doctor, and I said, I can't flourish here. I don't know what's wrong with me. And he said, go and sit under a halogen lamp for an hour a day, and then come back and see me in a month. And I realised I couldn't live without this light anymore, and I came back.
You needed the big sky. You were literally addicted to Australia.
I was like a plant, and I was just reaching for the sun here, Richard.
So once you made the decision to migrate permanently, were you consciously or unconsciously trying to get out from under your mum and dad, the influence of your mum and dad?
Well, all my friends told me that, but, you know, I didn't see it for years. I'd go, no, 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 you know, I'm here because, and then I'd cite some kind of professional opportunity. But of course, I must have been putting as great a distance as I could between myself and my parents, because, you know, if I'd been just across the pond in France, their tentacles could have reached me there. You know, their tentacles reached me everywhere. I remember once going on holiday with some girlfriends in my gap year before I took up the job at Vogue. I went to Israel, worked on a kibbutz with some girlfriends, and then crossed the Sinai Desert. And in the middle of the Sinai Desert, in the middle of bloody nowhere, someone came walking across the sand and handed me a fax, and it was from my father. He could find me in the middle of a desert. That was biblical.
There's that prayer again. You went back for a family holiday in France, which was just disastrous. Like, instead of all this hostility that's there, and it kind of led to a breakup with your parents. You were estranged from them. Didn't really communicate with them properly for about 3 years. I don't know if you're conscious of this, but the way you write about that estrangement, that disastrous holiday, it's like a marriage breakup.
Gee, nobody said that to me before. That's so interesting, isn't it? Yeah. God, it was violent. And, you know, we had a way of being violent with each other that was silent. So my father was a champion sulker. And I do remember once there was a sulk between him and me at the dinner table. Well, at the table, it went from breakfast through to dinner, which lasted for 3 weeks. My mother was the poor meat in the sandwich, sitting on the side just thinking, oh, my God, the pair of you, you are so ridiculous. But neither of us would cede power to the other.
Who gave in?
I can't remember.
It must have been you, because you would remember if you'd won, I'm sure, wouldn't you?
You think winning is not... Yes. But you see, I'm not competitive enough for that, I told you. I can't remember. True. But he did infect me with the sulking thing, and so that estrangement for 3 years was absolutely terrible, and I had to sort of, you know, I had to really think hard, Richard. I had to think they might die before we're reconciled, and I will have to live with that for the rest of my life. And when I became estranged from them, we really were at the absolute outer limits. We just couldn't tolerate each other anymore. And I think that 3 year silence and gap was necessary. And I had judged people who were estranged from their parents harshly before I did it myself. I thought that they were selfish. I now understand how much you might need a breather to get away from all of that claustrophobia and all of that toxicity and control.
Yes, don't you think there needs to be this happens so often, I think. There's a power shift that goes on as well, because they're going into retirement. They're not at the peak of their powers anymore, and you're on the ascendant now as you're coming into middle adulthood. There has to be a kind of resignation of power from them and an accession to you as the... But there's only one of you. That's the problem here, I suppose, isn't there? As the, I don't know, the alpha adult. Is that the word I'm looking for? It's a terrible phrase, I know. But that takes, I think sometimes it takes parents a very long while to get to used to resigning that power as they're becoming essentially the elder, the respected elders, rather than the primary agent in the family.
I guess so. I've never thought of it that way. But all I can say is that, yes, the estrangement took place in Paris on one of my mother's significant birthdays. So it was a particularly charged and terrible occasion on which to split. But the lovely conclusion to that story is that our reconciliation also took place in France. And despite the fact that the estrangement episode happened in Paris, where we were often a bit fraught and a bit tense, and Paris is all about the sort of the grand formality, and sometimes that can sort of, you know, bring out the worst in people. But when you get to the South, where we had traditionally as a family always been happy and always been our best selves, we met 3 years on in the South of France, and I can only say that what happened there was the greatest personal experience of grace I have ever felt, because we never discussed it. My parents never said, we forgive you for being a terrible daughter. And I never said, please, will you accept my apology? We never discussed it. We just met for Christmas. And Christmas in our family was not traditionally a time of great goodwill, it has to be said. So things were sort of a bit stacked against us. It was a high stakes kind of encounter. My husband, David, had gone ahead and sort of laid the foundations, almost like a sort of emissary or a diplomat. And we forgave each other and moved on. And my God, we needed to do that, because 2 years later, I needed to be the best possible daughter when I was faced with family crisis.
Yeah, it's time to talk about that crisis now. Your dad had bowel cancer, had to have an operation, and in that process he suffered a series of miniature strokes, I suppose, and suffered vascular dementia. And this is quite a different thing to Alzheimer's, isn't it, Caroline?
It is, because it's sudden, Richard. So, you know, we lost him overnight. One moment he was a completely coherent, extremely articulate man, and the next moment he was a gibbering lunatic. It was absolutely terrifying. I thought initially that this was the after effects of the anaesthetic, so I kept saying to my mother, he'll be fine, just wait for the anaesthetic to wear off. And then he started absconding from our home in the middle of the night in his pyjamas, barefoot, in the middle of a snowstorm. And I could only think of his favourite Shakespearean character, King Lear. He absolutely was Lear on the heath in those moments. And then his behaviour became more aggressive and dangerous and erratic. And I had to take him back to hospital. And then finally we got a diagnosis. And they told us that it was vascular dementia, which is sudden, and so there's no time to adjust or prepare. It was like an act of terrorism, a bomb that went off in my father's brain.
How did your mum cope with this sudden transformation of her
husband? She had a complete nervous breakdown. I don't know whether you remember in The Wizard of Oz, that witch that melts and becomes a puddle.
Yeah, yeah. So the Witch of the West, yeah.
Yes, my mother sort of became a puddle, or like a brown paper bag that just immediately sort of collapses in on itself. And the global financial crisis was happening in parallel. So it was a great year. It was 2008. I turned 50. The world was in financial meltdown. And my father was suddenly lost to us. And my mother just went to bed, turned her face to the wall and said, "I want to die."
Oh, so I suppose being an only child, then you're alone in dealing with all that.
That was the most alone I've ever felt in my life. I thought I knew what alone was until that moment. And, you know, I know that it's no easier in many regards when you have siblings, because siblings don't always agree on what needs to be done. This is what people keep telling me. They say, you know, it could be worse. You could have siblings going, "It's time to put him in a home." "No, it's your turn. You've got to take care of him," whatever. But there was this incredible weight on my shoulders. I could feel it like a kind of lactic acid building up in my muscles day after day, with me thinking, what is the right thing to do now? How do I become the good daughter they need me to be? Who do I look after first? You know, it was absolutely terrifying. And my adorable, wonderful husband, who was stuck back here in Australia, I was sobbing down the phone to him one day and saying, "I just don't know what to do." And my role model in all things was CJ Craig from The West Wing. I loved CJ because she was so competent and articulate and witty. She was absolutely my number one heroine.
And she was an only child with a father with dementia in that series too.
Mm. Was she?
Yeah.
I've completely forgotten that.
Yeah,
Richard.
She went back to see her husband in the woods, her father in the woods, and he had dementia.
Yes.
And he was a fabulous, charismatic man who was losing bits of himself.
I had totally forgotten that. Mm. But my adorable husband, David, sent me a boxed set via Amazon by emergency courier so that I could watch a few episodes of The West Wing and kind of recharge myself with some of CJ's courage so that I would be able to work out what to do.
That works, though. That
plan, it did.
Yeah. Because remember, on her desk, she had a post-it note saying, "What would Leo do?" That was her thing, remember? She looked to Leo, her predecessor, as chief of staff to the president. Do you remember when we could think the occupant of the White House could be...
Those were the days.
That well organised. Wasn't that a marvellous thing back in those days? You were able to find him some residential care, and meanwhile you were going through all his papers and found out that he'd sort of been getting himself involved in scams as he got older.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
Apparently what happens to the brain often when it's hit by vascular dementia is that it sort of triggers a gambling process, or an addictive process rather, in the brain. And so it's not uncommon for people with various kinds of dementia to suddenly become very susceptible to scams. And my father had signed up for dozens and dozens of lotteries promising him immeasurable wealth. He'd been defrauded of a very large amount of money as a businessman, and that had nearly broken him 25 years earlier. And he had this desperate, desperate desire to provide for us before it was too late. And so he rationalized all of this as being a completely legitimate way to make some money in his retirement. And then the gambling, the lotteries, then attach new parasites to you because they they send correspondence from clairvoyants who say, I can see that if you sign up for this lottery, immeasurable wealth will be coming to you, Harry.
Oh, God. Oh, these are terrible people.
Ghastly.
Oh, they're... So, in a way, I suppose this is your kind of Twilight of the Gods, isn't it? I mean, he liked his Wagner, but it's like this father you could mistake for God himself, had you'd seen him as much more mortal.
Well, and yeah. Wagner was very big in our house, so yeah. My father did see himself as Wotan, and he frequently called me Brunhilde. So, you know, that reference you gave just there, that's no joke. But, I mean, the big achievement really was that at the end, you know, when I was absolutely desperate to work out what to do with him and how to find the best care, I suddenly remembered that the fact of his being Jewish could influence where he might be allowed to go. And there was no doubt in my mind that the Jewish care home in London was the equivalent of the sort of five-star hotels that we were used to staying in when I was a child. And so I fought tooth and nail to get him in there. And whilst I played on his Jewishness, I said, he needs to be able to speak to a rabbi and he needs to be able to eat kosher food, which was complete nonsense because we'd never done any of that. My father would say that I was being very economical with the truth in that moment. But I think, you know, one of the saddest, most poignant things for me is one of his mottos was nothing but the best. And I tried to give my father at the end nothing but the best. And I knew that he would never know that I had fought that hard for him. He would never get the chance to feel proud of me for that.
You know, Caroline, for so much of your life, you struggled to be recognised as a good daughter. I mean, you can know you're a good daughter, but this is important for you to have heard your mother say you're a good daughter?
Yes, very, very, very.
Really? Really?
Even? Yes. It's really important to me. And she gave me a birthday card a few years ago, which said to the best daughter in the world. And I absolutely cherish that card. I cannot throw it away. I have to say, Richard, that in writing this book, I probably have lost a few brownie points on the good daughter scale. I have dropped back somewhat. But I'm very, very moved and very touched by the fact that just last week, my mother said to me, because we Skype each other every day, and I'm hoping that she's going to come out and live with me here later this year. She's very, very keen to do that because I am her sole surviving relative. She said to me just last week, I've watched the trailer for your book and I like it. She doesn't like the book. She stopped reading it two-thirds of the way through. I completely respect her decision to not carry on. I think she's found it very painful in terms of the fact that I have taken her life and written things that she, as a generation that has a particular sense of what privacy means, feels that it is, in a sense, a violation. But if she likes the trailer, that's good enough for me.
Caroline, thank you so much for coming on the program and sharing your amazing story today. Can you go and have another life now so you can write another memoir, please?
With pleasure.
abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.